The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Glory, glory, Man United. Jose's men stun Juve with a late comeback after Ronaldo's stunner. Liverpool go all Spursy in Belgrade while Spurs grow a spine just in time to see off PSV and keep their hopes alive. Man City score six again as Raheem Sterling trips over a leather-bound copy of Football Leaks that someone left lying on the Etihad turf. Elsewhere, David Squires joins us to talk cartoons and flog his excellent book. We'll look ahead to the Europa League and this weekend's games. Add your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Jonathan writes, how long will Max go without mentioning that the podcast and his radio show are nominated for an award? Not very long. Barry Glendening, nice to see you.
And nice to see you too, Max.
Did you know we've been nominated twice, you and I?
I did. I hear that people can vote for us at the Football Supporters Federation website.
Which is an excellent website anyway, so go there and vote for us twice.
And you can also join the Football Federation Supporters... And you can also join the Football Supporters Federation for free, which is a very worthy thing to do.
Hi, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
What'd you have for breakfast?
I had a bit of rice with some like sriracha sauce mixed in and then a couple of fried eggs on top of there.
Okay.
I would usually have it with tuna, but we were out of tuna. So eggs instead.
Tuna for breakfast. Paul McInnes.
All right, mate.
Welcome.
Thank you.
How's life out of 10?
I tell you what, mate. I've been shaggered. I've just been on the, you know, the sort of bleeping battery levels of energy of late.
You're in the red zone.
We're in the red zone. Okay. I've just been working too hard for the Guardian cause, mate.
Will we see you flag towards the end of part three?
Absolutely not, if you provide me with snacks in between two and three.
Okay, marvellous. Let's start then with Manchester United's win in Turin, 2-1 over Juve. Since 2003, Juve had only lost once in the Champions League group stages at home. They hadn't conceded a goal in the Champions League this season, unbeaten in all competitions, not conceded more than a single goal in 13 games. Lee says, even your panel will struggle to lay into United tomorrow after that. I have no doubt you'll give it a good go, though. Lars?
Well, as your followers on Twitter, Max, will know, you convened an emergency meeting of the anti-Mourinho media conspiracy this morning. And I think the result of that meeting was, the line is very much, well, Juventus were the better team throughout. They created many more chances and United got back into it through a free kick and a set piece and an own goal from a set piece. Now, that is all kind of true. But I tend to think... I thought they were better. I thought they were so much better if you compare to the Old Trafford game against United, even before the comeback. If you compare the first half Man United put up here with what they did at home to Juventus, that those were worlds apart, I thought, even if Juventus created more chances. They look. There's more of a structure to it. The players look like they know what they're doing. It seems more solid and more accomplished. I think Juventus probably shaded it, but there wasn't a gulf in class in the same way it was at Old Trafford, and that's got to be very positive.
Is that a tactical thing? Is that a just wanting it more thing, or is that a personnel thing?
Straightforwardly going away to play, going away to Italy and playing where you're the underdogs, it just suits Mourinho. You can dig in then, you're not going to have people having a pop at you. At Old Trafford, I was there for that game. You know, the people are expecting, the crowds are expecting them to go at Juventus and be the dominant side, and United is struggling to do that.
I think it could be there could be a bit more belief in the team as well. Like, they've had a decent run of performances now after halftime in the Newcastle game, after they turned that around. The Juventus game came after that, I realise, but in general they've had a couple of results where, okay, they've not played amazingly well, but they've had some positive experiences together. And I think it is really interesting that the players who are kind of driving this positive run of form are, shall we say, not who we would look at as Mourinho favourites. Like, Martial has been really good. Mata's made some really important involvements. You know, Pogba has had a couple of decent games. So players who has had every reason to not be wild about their boss are really doing very well for him and for the team right now.
Barry, you spent quite a lot of time talking about the first half, Manchester United, and actually... You know, in recent games, you're looking confused, saying that they come out of a game and they're terrible until the second half.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I actually thought they started this game quite well against a very good team.
I thought they were good throughout. Rode their luck a little bit. I mean, the one Cuadrado miss after Cristiano Ronaldo had put Juventus ahead could have killed the game if he'd scored that, and he should have done a lot better. But My anti-Marino caveat here will be that this is a game United could afford to lose. And I think that may have given him that, and possibly his just kind of hatred of Juventus would have given him the idea, let's just go for this. And they went for it from the start in a manner they haven't in other games. Thought they kept their shape well throughout. As I say, rode the luck a little bit, but I would say they were pretty worthy winners.
And it's also, they were, let's be straight about it, they were lucky to be in it at 1-0. Like, Juventus should have scored more goals. Mm. But it, for me, it's just such a striking difference between the way the players looked and the desire that was shown. If you compare this to, say, the West Ham away defeat, where it was just a complete shambles and no one looked like they wanted to be there, this looks like a very, very different team.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they were 1-0 down, and if Allegri hadn't sort of made that Barzagli substitution, which is, you know, oftentimes, you know, legendarily effective, but the guy's 37, and sometimes it might go wrong, particularly when you're asking Cuadrado to go into the wing-back position. It just suddenly opened up a little bit of space in that last 5 minutes, and the dynamic changed. If that hadn't happened, United probably would have lost the game. So there's probably a possibility that you can overread what's happened here. But I do agree with Lars that I think things have settled down at the club. You know, if you look back to where they were in September, the sort of the back and forth between him and Pogba in the press every match, something, there must have been some accord reached now. There's a bit of peace there. And again, you know, with players like Martial coming through, Shaw being the leader of that. Again, he had another good game last night. And I think it feels like the tide is moving in Mourinho's favour in terms of, are they going to do what he wants them to do on the pitch?
Did anyone else think? I thought Pogba had a terrible first half. I mean, I thought he looked like one of those players who was just trying. He just refused to give the ball early and easy. Unless he had to give it first time, he didn't. And every time he got it, he tried to overplay, and then he wasn't concentrating and miscontrolled the ball. And I thought, sort of, without him, I thought everyone else did really, really well.
Yeah, he's a player, you know, he wants to be a marquee, you know, global marquee. And plus, he's going back to the club where he, you know, he first made his name properly on the field. So he wanted to show. And that, you know, there isn't much space in a United setup for a Mourinho United setup for somebody to be that flair player who everything is conducted around. You've got to be a part of a team unit, particularly when you're playing against Juventus, who are going to close down a lot of space.
Sure, but you just don't try a 60-yard pass or five step-overs every time you get the ball. No. It's like when you play five-a-side with someone who does that, it's just really annoying.
I might have made this point before on the pod, but Pogba reminds me of a midfield equivalent of a young Ibrahimovic, really, in the sense that because he can do so many different things, he wants to do them all the time. This was a huge problem with Ibra for a long time. He wanted to be both the playmaker and the guy who put the cross in and the guy who headed the cross in, which physically is a very difficult thing to do. with Pogba, he wants to, yeah, he is a guy who can dribble and go past people, so he wants to do a lot of that. He can shoot, so he wants to get in positions to shoot. He can play amazing cross-field passes, so he wants to do that as often as possible. But I mean, I hate to sound like I'm almost agreeing with Graeme Souness here, but there's the sense that to play central midfield in a top team, you need to know a little bit more about when to do these things, and he doesn't always get it right.
Because he's got the ability to do it whenever he wants. It's just, you know, can't be guaranteed that will happen. And, you know, again, you know, he brings the look at that compared to what happens once Mourinho brought on Fellaini and Mata, two players who will play to the system, who will do the things that you expect them to do in that role, and they were more effective.
Barry, the Ronaldo strike was as glorious as the celebration was
weird.
Just so odd.
It's almost as if he is slightly narcissistic.
It's just. I mean, we should spend more time talking about what an amazing strike that was. But really, I can understand sort of showing off your, you know, Ginola showed off his abs, didn't he, in a Villa shirt, and it was kind of, hey, look at me, I'm fit. But he really sort of almost counted each one, didn't he? I mean, it was bizarre.
Yeah, I'm not sure what more you can say about it. I mean, his physical perfection as a specimen, we all know that. He certainly knows it. He's worked very hard on it. And I'm very jealous that I can't do the same thing, because if I did anything good and wheeled away in celebration like that, children would be frightened.
But what a volley, Lars.
It was Vardy-esque, wasn't it?
This the Vardy away at West Brom.
It was fantastic, and it's one of those things that's actually a lot harder than it kind of looks. It's one of those goals you hear a lot of ex-professionals go, "Wow," because it's when it's coming over the shoulder like that, and the way he doesn't break stride, and it's such an unbelievable. It's just a clean hit as well. Incredible goal.
Yeah. We had a guy in Norwich do a goal like that a few weeks ago, and it was a 50-yard pass, and he hit it first time, and it sort of bobbled in, and we were like a work of genius. And this guy's doing it in the space of, well, the pass has gone, what, 25, 30 yards. The space he's got to control it in is about 4 yards. Not only does he, and he's got a guy on him, he's in a sprint with a guy, and then he also controls it and also leathers it. I mean, everything about it was just perfection.
Jose afterwards, he got some criticism when cupping his ear Hulk Hogan style at the Juve fans afterwards. He says, "I didn't offend anyone at the end. I just made a gesture that I wanted to hear them louder. I probably shouldn't have done it. And with a cool head, I wouldn't have done it. But with my family insulted, including my inter family, I reacted like this." Do we give him a pass for Hulk Hogan?
Jose Mourinho has in the past poked Tito Villanova in the eye. He's basically had Anders Frisk, a well-respected referee, hounded into retirement. He treated a Chelsea team doctor appallingly and tried to trash her reputation. He's insulted various fellow managers, regularly thrown players under the bus, and insulted journalists. I'm not going to clutch my pearls just because he cupped his ear at some Juventus fans who were slagging him off for 90 minutes.
And surely, if you're a Man United fan, this is what you want to see. You want to see Mourinho in his full sort of strident battle mode, not just looking surly and like he doesn't want to be there all the time.
On Irish television, Graeme Souness criticised him for his lack of sportsmanship. The same Graeme Souness who once planted a Galatasaray flag in the centre circle.
But wasn't he flagged up on that by Mick McCarthy?
I believe so, yes.
Which I would have loved to see. Also, on the Mourinho thing, he was asked, well, he was chatting to Swedish TV afterwards about it, and he was making the point, as he'd made, that he was copping a lot of abuse throughout the game, so he, being Mourinho, he turned the question back on the journalist, as he likes to do, and he asked the reporter, you know, "Do you speak Italian?" And she says, "No." Well, and then he suggested, "Well, the FA, you should ask them, maybe they can translate for you," which I thought was a very, very good joke.
It was
and
funny.
This is sort of Mourinho enjoying himself and being slightly mischievous. And like when we criticise Mourinho, as people have done a lot this season, it's not because he's being a tool necessarily, it's just because he's been so dour and miserable. But now this is more of the sort of glint in the eye, sort of having a bit of fun with it and being a provocateur Mourinho that we saw many years ago, and I'm all for that.
That's obviously because the FA have appealed. Jose got away with swearing at the cameras. The FA have appealed it. That will go on. Also in that group, Valencia 3, Young Boys 1. Santamina scored twice. So Valencia go to Juve. Knowing anything but a victory would see them eliminated if Manchester United defeat Young Boys at Old Trafford. It is the Manchester derby this weekend. Cathal says, "How do you solve a problem like Lukaku? United seem to play better without him. He's like that friend you don't really like but can't phase out or loan to West Ham."
Well, it can. But no, I think away to Juventus, it probably makes sense to have someone slightly more mobile up there, or someone a bit higher who runs around a bit. Not that Lukaku doesn't run, but it's slightly different with Sanchez. I think if you're trying to batter a lower half team at home, Lukaku might be a handier fella to have up front. But there's no great shame in rotating him, I don't think.
It just seems to be there's always somebody at Old Trafford who has to be, you know, on the naughty step. And it seems like it's Lukaku at the minute, you know, suddenly dropped. He was playing every single week, and then one week he's like not in the squad altogether. And there's, you know, everybody wants to talk about Lukaku now. I mean, he has been playing badly and he hasn't been scoring a lot of goals, but I'm not sure Sanchez has done much more in the two games he's had up front.
So, yeah, City United, that's on Sunday. We'll look ahead to the rest of the Premier League games in part three. Liverpool's defeat at Red Star. Brendan says, "Was Liverpool's defeat to Red Star the most Spursy thing that they've ever achieved?"
It's a good question.
They weren't very good.
They were very bad, I would suggest. Virgil van Dijk is normally held up as, you know, the bastion of all that is good about, well, one of several bastions of everything that's good about Liverpool. I thought he had a very poor game. I think the second goal they conceded, there was about five different individual errors in the build-up to that.
Great finish, though.
It was a good finish, yeah, absolutely.
It was a bit of a Kloppian goal to score, really. Finish was great and all that, but when they won possession in the opponent's half with three players being quite close to the ball, and then the finish is obviously amazing, but yeah, that was strange to see Liverpool concede the kind of goal you'd expect them to score, really.
Quite a lot of people on social media, so we should probably ignore them, but, you know, have sort of said this defeat has been coming, that Liverpool have been sort of phoning it in a little bit recently. Paul, would you go with that?
Well, I haven't been following Liverpool as closely this season as previous, but when I have seen them, they've been a bit stodgy. But that, it seems to be because they're moving towards a more of a possession-based, rather than countering, or counter-pressing rather, more of a possession game that gives them more control over matches. I think in this instance, I think it was a case if he signalled a rotation. You know, there was key players out in central defence, Sturridge started up front, and I think they set out with thinking they would win this game without too much difficulty. And in the end, you know, they had chances to take the lead in the first half, didn't take them, and then you know, they were quickly 2-0 down. So that sort of changes the whole dynamic, and it was too difficult for them to come back.
It's difficult to imagine that complacency could happen in professional football, because, you know, that's all you're doing is gearing up to win this game, right? So, you pick your team, you set them out, you do it tactically, you warm up properly, you have the team talk. But you do wonder if in players' minds they think, oh, well, someone will win this game for us at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it might even be, you know, they're still kind of hyped for it, but they're just not quite as hyped as they might otherwise be if they were playing at home against PSG, for example. You know, it doesn't take... They know they have to be at their best to try and compete, whereas they probably suspect they don't have to be in this game. But yeah, I mean, you know, we're going to talk about City. There are ways and means of rotating, and part of the challenge for Liverpool as a, you know, a top side now, they want to be competing for everything, is that you have to be able to rotate and still play well.
Yeah, because Klopp brought in Sturridge, he brought in Lallana. They both had very poor games. I thought Sturridge was, I think, trying too hard. And Lallana just looked weak. I'm happy to concede he's just back from a long spell out with injury and probably isn't fully match fit. I'm not sure I agree complacency was a problem. I have a feeling they may have been affected by the, first of all, the hostility of the crowd. I mean, what a crowd that was.
Extraordinary.
And what an atmosphere they created. And this is at a team whose average gate for home games is maybe 6,000-7,000 on average. And also, the Red Star that played Liverpool on Tuesday night did not look in any way related to the, you know, craven, cowardly outfit that turned up at Anfield. You know, they wanted that game, and this was a huge, huge game for them and a huge result in their history, and they should be applauded for that.
They took a point off of Napoli as well at home, so they're no mugs in that regard. I think it's interesting. There has been this theory this season that Jurgen Klopp has had Liverpool take their foot off the gas a little bit and not play the sort of mad heavy metal pressing game in every game, because it wears them out and they run out of gas at the end of the season. And like you said, Paul, be a little bit more possession focused. But I think it's a very short road from there to actually taking your foot too far off the gas and losing some of the qualities that made them very, very good to begin with.
Could we have a word for the tunnel at the Maracanã? What a feat of engineering. It's like this narrow tunnel, bricked walls, sort of curved. It's like a dungeon in a medieval castle or something, painted red and white. And Steve McManaman on BT Sport was saying it takes like about a minute. It's so long. It takes about a minute to walk from the dressing rooms to get to the pitch. And, you know, while you're going through, you can hear it's normally covered in graffiti. He reckoned they'd given it a lick of paint for the big night. And you could, you know, you can hear this din and, you know, rumbling on your way out. And he said it's incredibly, incredibly intimidating.
It sort of makes it feel like sort of gladiatorial,
yeah,
doesn't
yeah.
it?
Well, I kind of was thinking, I don't know if you remember during Gladiator, they're waiting to go out and one of them like pees himself with fright. And that kind of came to mind. But it was a magnificent tunnel.
Of the starting 11, would you like to guess which one did a number one accidentally?
No.
Fine. Also in that group, Napoli won, PSG won.
How about James Milner? But he just owned it. I mean, he just did it. And it's like, I don't mind. It's fine. We're going to fight. I wee before I fight.
Juan Panat's got his first PSG goal. He's good finish as he was falling after some good work from Mbappe. Gigi Buffon made some good saves, didn't he, Lars, for PSG?
Yes.
You'd say Napoli, at the very least, deserved a point out of that game.
I thought they did, yeah. And they, again, continue to look better than certainly I would have thought and a lot of people would have thought after Ancelotti took over. And I think Ancelotti's proving a lot of people wrong there. And I suppose there was this theory, and I may or may not have espoused this theory myself, so I should hold my hand up there to say that what Ancelotti does is he keeps groups of very talented players happy, and he doesn't maybe do that much tactical work or that much stuff on the training grounds. The theory was when he took over at Napoli, when he had a squad that perhaps doesn't have the illustrious names and maybe needs a coach to make them more than the sum of their parts, it wouldn't work at all. But I've been proven very wrong in that so far. And I suppose what you could say about Ancelotti, it's not really his fault that these massive sort of billionaire teams have been throwing money at him to keep all these egos in line for years and years. And he hasn't really had a chance to show what he can do with a slightly more malleable team. And so far, it's looking very good.
Spurs 2, PSV 1. Paul, you were there.
Yes, I was.
Did you enjoy it?
46,500 people. I got a lot of stick for that because I wrote a piece about how the Atmos at Wembley was doff. Mm-hmm. And it was. And it's been three games now where it's sort of half empty and it feels almost funereal. It feels like things are sort of gradually winding down, which of course they are. And I think a lot of Spurs fans have had enough. The pricing's not right. A lot of the ticketing stuff is problematic. And, you know, people want this new stadium. And I got in trouble because people were saying, yeah, but the attendance was artificially capped. And I'm like, yeah, it was artificially capped because they knew they weren't going to sell out. But anyway, that's by the by. The atmosphere wasn't great. Spurs want to move on. There's a sort of parallel between that and their Champions League campaign because it's kind of, it's going to take an awful lot for them to get out of this group and it seems unlikely. And there's a bit of that feeling that it was winding down. I think that's another reason why people didn't want to go to the game. However, Spurs won. And they did so with a bit of fight and determination in the second half. First half, they were created two or three really good chances. Wirt, the PSV keeper, looks like a little hamster. He made about five brilliant saves. One double save.
Zoot from the Muppet Show.
Well, there we go.
Does he look more like a hamster than Barry Fry?
He could be Barry Fry's hamster cousin.
Right, okay.
You know, something like that. But he made one double save in particular was great. But Spurs were already 1-0 down by this point. Sort of the tempo went down in the second half. It looked like it was just going to sort of ebb away. Then Harry Kane, bang, you know, one touch, edge of the box, goal sort of thing. He does so well or it's traditionally done so well. And then they sort of, you know, the pressure mounts and then there's a double deflected goal and it's a win. And then the noise at the end was louder than anything that preceded it. The PSV fans were great, by the way, but Spurs fans really liked that. They liked the fight. They liked the determination. And I think that's one of the things about this Spurs team. You know, they have challenges and they're certainly, I don't think, the most accomplished squad. I think, you know, put the 11 out there maybe, but the most accomplished squad. But they keep fighting and they're still in it.
At 1-0 down, I was watching this and I was watching Harry Kane, Barry, and I was just thinking, Spurs need to find a different way of playing to be able to take him off, and then he scored two. So it shows what I know. But I don't, basically, you just have to keep him there, don't you? It doesn't matter how tired he might be or how sort of not interested he looks or how badly he's playing.
Well, do you? I don't necessarily agree.
I think if Son is match fit, and they will use Son as an alternative striker.
You know, not many strikers are as good as Harry Kane in form. So, yes, ideally you would have him out there. But if he went off injured, say, for example, I would have a lot of faith in Son. There are other players in the Spurs team who can put the ball in the net. So, I wouldn't. While, obviously he's their best player, you could argue. Well, maybe Eriksen, but he's in a different role. But, yeah, I don't agree with you, Max.
That's okay.
I actually thought Llorente looked more useful than he often has done for Spurs when he came on, because I thought they were using him correctly. So many times they put on Llorente and they've kept playing it on the floor and he's just looked lost. Whereas here they put on Llorente and they started hoofing it to him, which is what you want to do, because he'll beat most people in the air.
And he's so handsome.
Can I, as an aside, say I enjoyed seeing Trent Sainsbury come on for PSV Eindhoven. Do you think Cardiff should sign him so they could have Trent Sainsbury and Morrison at the back?
Oh, nice idea. Is there an Aldi
Dave
anywhere?
Tesco. I don't think exists.
Spurs have just kept 4 clean sheets in 17 games this season, which does seem to be a problem, right? Although Gazzaniga in goal played very well. I've written better than Lloris, question mark. I mean, I don't think
Lloris is in bad form. But I mean, he was playing a 4-1-4-1 formation against PSV, and the one in midfield was Harry Winks, who's not exactly your natural idea of a midfield enforcer. I think Spurs' problem is getting the first goal, getting the second goal in games a lot of the time, actually, I think. So I think he might be opening it up to take more risk, try and get goals, and then occasionally letting them in at the back.
Like against Wolves. As long as they get the first three.
Well, exactly. the game was won, and you know, that was guy making his Premier League debut, wasn't he? He was all over the place.
Right, Barcelona almost did Spurs a big favour. Malcolm put them 1-0 up 90 seconds after coming on at Inter, with just 7 minutes left before Mauro Icardi's equaliser 4 minutes later. I've been spending a lot of time talking about bad away kits, but Barcelona could really easily wear their first team kit against Inter, in my opinion. And they wore pink with it's two shades of pink. I would call it pink and a salmon, sort of on one corner. It was very upsetting, Lars.
You're easily upset by team shirts, aren't you?
Mm.
It's just something that doesn't register with me at all, unless they're really bad, like the time Barcelona played in something that looked like an ice lolly.
Mm.
That was unsettling. But this sort of minutia that you get into doesn't really do much for me. But...
Producer Jonathan's saying this is proper football man stuff here.
Yeah, probably.
Complaining about how it isn't how it used to be.
Yeah,
but there is,
right.
I mean, there's a released lower league player called Jimmy Spencer, who, along with the now retired German footballer Torben Marx, could join Trent Sainsbury.
Is that what you've been doing?
I think
so. I'm going to end this part just so Lars stops getting supermarkets.
I saw a Marks and Spencer's delivery lorry this morning.
Okay.
On my way to work. It was parked up outside my local M&S with a giant poppy on the front grill. So if you're listening, James McLean, you might want to take your business elsewhere.
Aldi Rinaldi is an Indonesian footballer who currently plays for Semen Padang in the Indonesian Super League. And that's a great way to end part one. In part two, we'll start with Manchester City on the pitch, and then we'll discuss the football leak story after that.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the 29th of November at the Emanuel Centre in London, there's a live show featuring me, you, Barry.
Hello.
Jonathan Wilson, and surprise guest to be announced. I don't know if it's because we've asked everybody on the pod and no one could do it, or we're still waiting, or it has been decided and it's going to be a big announcement, or it's going to be like an unveiling, like who was put in that big glass box at the start of the season?
Oh, Santi Cazorla.
That's it. Will it be like a Santi Cazorla?
I think it was Gökhan Inler was sort of revealed in a bizarre manner when he signed for Napoli. I think if I recall this correctly, they called a press conference and he just appeared on a stage with like a lion's mask on his head or something, and they pulled it off and it was Gökhan Inler, and it wasn't actually that exciting.
It's a huge anti-climax.
Yeah.
That's like when Cambridge before the season go, big announcement in an hour. It doesn't matter. They're not going to sign Ronaldo, are they? It's going to be someone who scored 10 in 80 for Carlisle. Like, it's just never going to be exciting, isn't it? Okay, then Man City 6, Shakhtar 0. The second time in 4 days City have scored 6. The 8th time this season they've won a game by 3 goals or more. Just one defeat so far this season. 2 draws, 15 wins. The penalty decision was amazing, wasn't it? I mean, Raheem Sterling just sort of tripping himself up on the turf in a sort of humorous Sunday league way.
Don't you think it's like only the trip that an elite athlete could do, though? Because your legs are so sort of... They're just in such a particular position in order to maximise speed that you're only going to... You know, it's only... Normal people would be running legs akimbo like that.
Not running at all, in my case.
So what, if I was running and hit the... I would just stop running. I wouldn't fall over because I'm not going fast enough. I'd just be like, ow. I look like an idiot.
Can we just stop for a minute?
Okay, so the question is, should Raheem Sterling have said, hey, guys... I wasn't fouled. Danny Murphy on the radio this morning was saying he should have said something, but he did caveat it with, you're already beating Shakhtar Donetsk at home. It's not like it's the last minute of the World Cup final. So his morals depend on the importance of the game and the moment. He could have quite easily earned himself some brownie points here, couldn't he?
Yeah, but that would be putting I in team. I mean, he's thinking about the team here. The team wants the goal.
Yeah, no, I kind of go along with that logic. I mean, PR-wise, for him, it would have been amazing. Like, he would have been known as the sort of fair play
icon. Do you think the tabloids would have found a way...
Robbie Fowler de Nozure.
No, the tabloids would have found a way to criticise him, Raheem Sterling.
Oh, Raheem Sterling, I'm sure the set headlines would have been selfish Sterling costs team penalty. But, listen, we don't do this with any other situation in the game. Like, for instance, this is not whataboutery, it's just a general point, but, like, when Herrera pulled down Dybala and they were both booked for some mysterious reason in the United game, Herrera didn't go to the ref and say, hey, that fella didn't actually do anything. And no one's calling for him to do that because that would be crazy. I mean, there's 100 situations, well, maybe not 100, but a lot of situations every game where there are small bits of dishonesty here and there. And at the end of the day, it's the referee's job to officiate. And I don't think it should be on Sterling to tell him he's wrong.
And it wasn't. And the thing was, it wasn't dishonesty. No. I mean, at least we're not thinking it was. No. He tripped. And so if he's not trying to con the referee's made a mistake. What's in it for him to try and make the mistake better for the ref?
Pep Guardiola said, you know, he knew straight away that it wasn't a penalty and said as much to his backroom team. And someone asked him, oh, well, could you not have told took the penalty? Jesus.
Yeah.
Just to pass the ball to the keeper or put it wide or something. And... He said, it didn't actually cross my mind to do that. Maybe I'll do it next time.
Sterling scored a absolutely beautiful goal. And Gabriel Jesus' hat-trick goal was a brilliant finish as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the few things that people remember about me with relation to this podcast is that I once said that Raheem Sterling was not a £50 million player. And I did this in the company of Jacob Steinberg, which is never wise anyway. And you know, he fixed me with his basilisk stare. I think I've actually said this on before on the podcast anyway. And I don't think he was a £50 million player at the time. He is now. And that's that sort of ability that he showed last night, because he basically squirreled away from 3-4 players and then banged it top corner from the edge of the box. There's very few players who can do that in world football. He's pushing himself up to another level.
Lyon 2, Hoffenheim 2. Lyon blew it here. They were 2-0 up. Hoffenheim were down to 10 men, but they still came back, equalising in the last minute. So City are on 9 points, Lyon on 6, Hoffenheim 3, Shakhtar 2. City go to Lyon next. Before we round up the rest of the Champions League, Der Spiegel have been releasing a fresh round of Football Leaks articles all about Manchester City, Barry, and how the owners... where they get money from and where they put money in a quite complicated but not entirely fair way.
I suppose the thing to remember from the start is these are allegations that are born out of the Football Leaks business, and they are allegations that in the past City have denied, but now that apparent documentary evidence to support these allegations has gone to Der Spiegel, they are no longer denying them. They're just, their answer to everything is the attempt to damage the club's reputation is organised and clear. So that's not a denial, it's just anything but. And the allegations are that City got up to a lot of scurrilous activity behind the scenes to get around the financial fair play rules. In summary, there's sort of 4 very long articles, but well worth your time. They believed financial fair play rules do not apply to them. Sheikh Mansour has been pumping millions and millions of pounds into the club, pretending that the money has been raised legitimately through sponsorship deals. The club basically sold its own image rights to itself to generate more revenue. And when UEFA sanctioned them with a £30 million fine, European football's government body was unaware that any of this was going on. They've also tried to control media portrayals of the club. They're obsessed with their own image. And oh, it turns out as well that Roberto Mancini, when he signed his contract with City, he was paid twice, once by City and once for his role as a consultant, in inverted commas, by Al Jazeera Sports and Cultural Club in Abu Dhabi. So the reaction to this has been quite funny. You know, it's important to remember, Manchester City, the club that most Manchester City supporters follow now, is in no way related to the one they used to support. You know, that was basically razed to the ground, eliminated from history, and a new one built, and they just stuck the name Manchester City on it. But football tribalism being what it is, fans will defend anything. The owners of City are not nice people. They wage war. They violate human rights. But their fans, the fans of the club they own, and the club they own to portray a good image to the Western world, will defend them anyway. And let's not pretend that other clubs, you know, their financial dealings aren't murky. But these are interesting revelations. City fans are saying, oh, well, we didn't do anything wrong, and the financial fair play rules, you know, were preventing us from getting through the glass ceiling and becoming an elite club. And that's fair enough to an extent. But the rules were there. City broke them, and there's no getting around that.
Do you think there should be FFP, Lars?
I think the rules are problematic because, like Barry says, it does prevent teams, wherever their funding comes from, to join the elite. I'm not wild about football clubs becoming basically sort of image laundromats for totalitarian regime. I don't think that's what football should be about, but it's problematic to me that you have a rule that basically, you know, makes sure the richest stay near the top almost. That's almost what FFP does. It becomes so hard for anyone to climb the ladder in any sort of way, and that's a flaw in the ruling. But I just think that's a completely separate issue to all the revelations around Man City. Like, you can't just break a rule because you think it's silly. That's not how the world works.
You lobby to get the rule changed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The thing that rankles with me is that there are clubs around Europe who have sold big players to comply with these rules. Like, Roma insists the main reason they sold Mohamed Salah was they needed to get their economy in order for financial fair play reasons. You've had like Turkish clubs have been banned completely for not complying with them. So the idea that City, because they have the sort of clout they have been able to go behind the scenes and get a helping hand allegedly from Gianni Infantino of all people, according to these papers, that's the thing I think will rankle with a lot of people, that they just don't, the rules don't seem to apply to them.
If you didn't have FFP though, City would be a way over the hill. You know, they would have spent twice as much money as they've had. So, you know, the number one aim or stated aim of FFP is to increase stability in football. And that doesn't necessarily, that's not necessarily talking about the Manchester United or Juventus of this world. You're talking about sort of more mid-ranking teams who might be a Leeds, for example, who might be tempted to speculate in order to accumulate and have it go completely wrong. And then, you know, fans, communities are left picking up the pieces. So if you take it in the round, you know, you can see that there are other reasons, or the sort of legitimate reasons for having FFP. And I also think if you didn't have it, you probably have an even more sort of separated elite than you do now.
So will anything happen to Manchester City? Should anything happen to Manchester City?
I think this should be sanctioned. I'm not sure UEFA are willing to do so because, you know, City can afford good law firms, and this could drag through the courts for years. Are UEFA up for that battle? Are UEFA prepared to sanction City? And perhaps, you know, this could be only be the tip of the iceberg. There could be plenty more revelations about other clubs to come. Are they going to be kicked out of the Champions League? I don't think so, because UEFA want them in the Champions League.
Do you have sympathy for Manchester City fans?
No.
Well, no, in the sense that, they don't have any control over who runs their football club.
But well, if you have control over whether they defend them to the hilt, whatever they do or not. Like, it's possible to be a fan of a club and still be critical about the people who run it.
Sure. I mean, there may be... I mean they can't all be...
I'm a Sunderland fan, and I was really, really critical of the Sunderland regime, particularly over the appalling manner they handled the Adam Johnson affair. Now, there are probably Manchester City fans who don't like the fact they're owned by, you know, human rights abusers. But on social media and Guardian comment sections, presumably, I haven't looked, or comments may not be open because of
they're not open.
On social media, you know, just this one-eyed tribalism of defending the indefensible from fans just because it's their team, I find it just so tedious. You know, grow a backbone, have an opinion of your own.
Can you ever see...
There's nothing wrong with being critical of your club if your club is doing something wrong.
Can you ever see players and managers making their decisions ethically? You know, choosing to join a team that isn't run by a totalitarian state?
I think there's probably all the evidence you need, or a telling, something that will tell you what you need to know about this situation, this One Matters Common Goal, which I think is still probably on about 60 players worldwide, and very few of them are in the elite tiers of the men's game. You know, it's a...
But could you defend, you know, someone who plays for Manchester City to say, do they have to take responsibility? Or PSG, so, you know, they are run by a regime that has human rights.
It's like journalists who work for, you know, The Sun. I mean, people don't think it's like, they think they're just doing their job. They don't hold themselves responsible for what the boss is doing.
There's a possible, there's a slight difference, I would argue, in that if you are a footballer who's at City, you could get another job where you're paid a huge amount of money. I think, you know, I would almost, like, there are newspapers that I wouldn't want to work for, but I could defend somebody who's 21 trying to get their foot in the door at when they're not being paid any money.
No, I wouldn't, but yeah, I can understand there's a debate on that, yeah.
Can I just make the point that I think these revelations are, in a way, worse for Man City's owners than they would have been if exactly the same thing had come out from other clubs, because it is, ostentatiously, it's a PR project for Abu Dhabi. You have a lot of clubs where the fans chant, no one likes us, we don't care. But that's not the case at Man City. The whole reason they're pumping all these money into Man City is because they want people to like them and to think they're nice. I can quote Khaldun Al-Mubarak, the chairman, from an interview in 2009 with The Guardian, where he said, "We're acknowledging that how we are handling this project is telling a lot to the world about how we are. The UAE is different from other Arab countries. People think the Arab world is one, but it's not. This is showing the world the true essence of who Abu Dhabi is and what Abu Dhabi is about." I mean, that is part of the idea behind the club. So when all these things are coming out about the true essence, about what they're really about, the people who run Man City and how they go about things and how they allegedly flaunt rules, that is more damaging for that club than it would have been for other clubs, I would argue.
And a lot of the City fans who are defending their owners to the hilt should think on this. They're just paid extras in this big PR movie that's going out. The owners of City couldn't care less about them as long as they keep turning up.
All right, let's look at the rest of the Champions League. Group A, Monaco 0, Club Brugge 4. Ooh. Thierry Henry is having a bad time, isn't he? Monaco's heaviest home defeat in European competition. They're out already. Atletico beat Borussia Dortmund 2-0. Lovely goals from Saul and Griezmann as well. So Dortmund and Atletico very likely to progress from that group. Group D, Porto 4, Lokomotiv Moscow 1. Schalke 2, Galatasaray 0. The first goal from that Schalke was from Guido Bergsteller, a mixture of Lacazette at the weekend and Carnoux for Arsenal years ago, where he sort of bent it in from the byline. Porto are top, Schalke are second. They both look likely to go through as well. Group E, Bayern Munich 2, AEK 0. Two penalties from Robert Lewandowski. Benfica 1, Ajax 1. Important equaliser for Ajax there from Dusan Tadic. That's where he is. Group G, Real Madrid won 5-0 at Victoria Pilsen. Pilsen started okay, hit the bar. Ramos may have shithoused his elbow. Yes, Paul?
He was asked about, he made a public statement about this affair. So okay. He sort of runs in on a challenge, raises the elbow where nobody can see, gets it right in the chops of a guy called Milan Havel. He says afterwards, I've spoken with him and sent him a message. I hope he gets better. There was contact, but no intention to cause any damage. The nose is very fragile, so any knock is dramatic, and I hope he recovers.
It's tremendous, isn't it? Well, let's hope he does. Let's hope. Just a bit of hope that he still has a nose.
Could maybe Sergio Ramos start his own Super League and just go play with himself for a while?
It's the third win under Santiago Solari for Real Madrid, two for Benzema. The first, a lovely run and finish. Casemiro and Bale made it 4-0 at halftime. Toni Kroos, after the break, scored a lovely chip, didn't he? CSKA Moscow 1, Roma 2. Lorenzo Pellegrini's first Champions League goal won it for Roma. Real and Roma both on 9 points, look likely to go through. It's the Europa League tonight. For the few of you that listen to the pod before these games happen, Arsenal host Sporting Lisbon. A win will see them qualify as group winners with two games to spare, with a 100% record so far. Arsenal won the reverse fixture 1-0 2 weeks ago. Danny Welbeck scored the only goal of that game. Chelsea travel to Bartek Borisov. Like Arsenal, they've got a 100% record. A win would see them qualify as group winners. They're missing a lot of players. Alonso, Luiz, Rudiger, Morata, Fabregas. Fabregas pulled out late with illness. The rest are being rested. Hat-trick hero of the reverse fixture, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, should see some more game time in Belarus. Fitbar Barry, Celtic host RB Leipzig. They lost 2-0 in Germany a fortnight ago. They're on just 3 points, so they probably need something out of this game. Brendan Rodgers says they can't afford to be timid. Since that defeat, though, they've won three on the bounce in the league, 13-4-0 against. If they lose and Salzburg avoid defeat, Celtic will go out along with Rosenberg, who are currently pointless. Mm. And Rangers travel to Spartak Moscow. Steven Gerrard's side topping Group G currently on away goals in their head-to-head record. 0-0 in Glasgow 2 weeks ago. Rangers could do with a result here, though. Spartak with just 5 home wins in Europe in the last decade. Are you all right, Barry?
So I just can't be dealing with the Europa League before Christmas.
I think your views are shared by many. In League One, Blackpool and Charlton picked up away wins over Gillingham and Walsall, respectively. Charlton move into the playoffs. Blackpool 3 points behind with a game in hand. And in League Two, Mansfield move into the playoff positions with a 2-1 win over struggling Grimsby. Notts County played out a goalless draw. And that'll do for part two. We'll be back in a tick chatting cartoons with David Squires. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. This is part three, everybody. We'll look ahead to this weekend's football in just a second. But first off, the Guardian's excellent cartoonist, David Squires, has got a book out, and so he's going to flog it on the pod. Let's say hello to David Squires. How are you, David Squires?
Hello, I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. What's your book called, and is it good?
My book is called Goalless Draws, and it is... The best book that anyone called David... I can't even say it's the best book anyone called David Squires has written, because I think there's someone who called David Squires who writes books about birds. but no, it's a collection of cartoons from The Guardian from 2014 to the recent World Cup. Cartoons drawn by me, I should add. And yeah, I had fun putting it together, and so hopefully the readers will enjoy it as well.
It begins with your, you know, how you started in drawing and how you forced your primary school teacher on a on what they wanted was a nice afternoon to have to go into detail about the Third Reich.
Yes, so we were set a task to draw a fantasy football team. And I was only about 10, just sort of learning about the horrors of the Second World War, and sort of combine those two burgeoning interests, of football and war. And I called my team the Berlin Burners, and had Hitler cracking in goose stepping in a volley from distance past a despairing goalkeeper, and then. The teacher had to give me a bit of a talking to about, you know, the use of that kind of imagery. It was the 80s. I mean, you sort of think it was okay back then, but no, it definitely wasn't.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't want to just talk to you about war, but, you know, Poppygate has come around again, and I have taken now to just sending that cartoon you did of Poppygate and the ridiculousness of it every time I see someone tweet about it.
I've noticed. Thank you. You're really earning that 78% as an agent. It's you're doing fantastic work for me. And it's attracted interest, good and bad. So thanks for that, Max. I know you're a divisive figure. So cheers for all the interest that's come my way there, mate.
In the news, obviously, there are recurrent themes. Obviously, Poppygate, you know, Jose is a recurrent theme. Do things happen, you think, oh, no, I've got to draw him again? Or are you just so easy and free that you're happy with whatever you have to reflect?
Jose has been a constant character throughout the last 4 years, and you know that there are one or two people who come up, and the Poppy thing again this year. I look at it and thought, well, the last 4 years I've done cartoons about Poppygate, and it's become sort of harder to exaggerate. The more you see, you know, stories about the kind of treatment that people like James McLean get, and just little snippets on social media. It's, like I say, it does become harder to sort of exaggerate that kind of thing. I did wonder whether it was something that was just sort of specific to football or to sort of the extremes you see on social media. But then a friend of mine told me that she was walking her dog, and someone came up and asked her why her dog wasn't wearing a poppy. So I'm not quite sure what's going on there.
David, you mentioned in passing there, a lot of us who write about football get abuse on Twitter and social media and on the Guardian website. Do you get much, or do people, you know, do the one-eyed tribalists get after you and get on your case, or you get to sort of escape that aspect of the job?
I think I'm aware I get off quite lightly. And as it was something I had to get used to when I started drawing the cartoons for The Guardian, that suddenly I had a bigger audience, and therefore I would be reaching more people who wouldn't like my cartoons, wouldn't like what I was saying or the way I was saying it. So I kind of got used to that. I don't go sort of actively looking for the feedback. My self-esteem is too fragile to have it, you know, my neurosis verified by an external party. So I usually just sort of crack on, and I live in my in the lovely echo chamber that I've cultivated on Twitter of people who are nice to me.
Do you feel, being far away as well, you can have a direct pop at people in football that... I'm always slightly nervous if I'm very critical of someone. I'm going to have to interview them on TalkSport about 5 seconds later.
Yeah, I guess it's slightly different for cartoonists. I think by our nature, we're sort of solitary creatures. You know, we hide away in our dark studios, and it's pretty rare that we go outside, let alone have to interview, I don't know, Ray Parler or someone. Yeah, I guess even if I lived in the UK, it's unlikely that I would sort of have direct contact with anyone that I'm drawing a cartoon about.
We're going to give away one of your books, David. We don't often do big competitions. It's exciting for all of us. Barry has donned a shiny suit to host it in a sort of game show style. But how are we going to give it away?
So I thought that to give away the book, a drawing competition. I liked it when you used to get people to draw, illustrate the pod. But in a previous life, I used to design mascots, football mascots. And so I thought it would be an idea to get the listeners to design a mascot for the Football Weekly pod.
That's a great idea. So if you want to draw a mascot, it can be any, you know, you've got total creative freedom. footballweekly@theguardian.com is the email address. We'll judge the winner next week. The book is called Goalless Draws. Thanks for coming on, David. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
David Squires over in Australia. Now he's gone, we can sort of blow some smoke up his backside, Barry. The cartoons are, you know, they're a sort of go-to thing, aren't they?
I think they're one of the highlights, not just on the sports end of the website, but the entire Guardian website. And there aren't too many things that get people on the sports desk excited, but the arrival of Squire's cartoon each week and the arrival, say, of Marina Hyde column are two things that leap immediately to mind.
And the writing of Paul McInnes and Lars.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
I don't write for The Guardian very often, so you know I can see why that would cause excitement. But can I just give a very recent example that's worth? I mean, the puppy one is great, and you keep putting it out there. I thought the one he did after the awful tragedy up at Leicester recently was stunning, because I thought about that, actually. How on earth is Squires going to turn this into anything? And my mind drew a complete blank, which is obviously why I'm not a cartoonist, but I thought it was just both poignant and somehow funny without being inappropriate, and it was just so impressively done, and he's so good.
Completely agree.
He just writes great gags. I mean, what really helps, I think, you know, he talks about it, social media has been a massive thing for disseminating all his content, and it's partly because you can share the whole strip or you can clip out a panel. And there's individual jokes amidst the whole kind of story thing going on. And plus, while, you know, he kind of gets at everybody, he's not mean.
Yeah.
You know, he does get, you know, I love, my favourite of his is Emo Mourinho. I just think it's a brilliant creation. But, you're sort of laughing. It's a silly mockery of him. It's not sort of nasty or spiteful, and I think that's also one of the reasons why it translates to so many people.
Right, let's look ahead to this weekend's football. Saturday is looking a little bit light, gentlemen.
I'm off to Palace.
Oh, you're going to see Palace Spurs, probably the pick of Saturday's games.
Yeah, it's not throbbing with them, is it? And it'll be interesting, because, you know, Palace have had some, well, been up and down. But I think their performance against Arsenal was pretty good.
Yeah, they played well there, but they've only two wins in this season, coming against Huddersfield and Fulham. I mean, you should beat them.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a eerie lack of points in the bottom half of the table that actually sort of a couple of wins set you in good stead.
I think Spurs might be a bit leggy as well after Tuesday. That heavy pitch, tough games, you know, emotionally draining and physically draining. Could be an interesting one.
Mm.
I think Newcastle Bournemouth is my pick of the Saturday one.
Why so, Barry?
Well, Newcastle are in dire straits, but going in on the back of a win, whereas Bournemouth's tails are very much up, but they're going in on the back of a defeat. It's last game for both teams before the international break. If Bournemouth's presumably harbouring notions of getting into Europe, and I think they're very realistic notions, they'll want to win. Newcastle want to build on the momentum. I think it could be a very entertaining game.
Monday Night Football, by the way, was Huddersfield 1, Fulham 0. Neil says, was the Huddersfield-Fulham game the most League 2 fixture played in the Premier League ever? Two terrible sides, but one slightly more terrible than the other.
Yeah, just Fulham, guys. Like, what are you doing? Like, I preferred them when they were at least scoring goals and looking completely incompetent at the back. Like, if you can't score... Oh my God! Like it's not looking very good for them, and you know,
and they go to Liverpool.
Good
on
news,
Sunday.
Fulham fans! You've got Liverpool away.
Yes. On Fulham, did you see that tweet from Archie Rintutt about the prices of tickets?
I'm keenly aware of this, because I think, like all right-minded people, I quite enjoy going to Fulham, even as a paying punter. Especially as a paying punter, it's a really nice sort of stroll through the park by the river, and it's a lovely old stadium, and they've got a nice team and all that. But it's just so expensive now.
£55 to £75 for a home game for an adult at Fulham.
At least you're guaranteed goals.
That is true.
What are the season ticket price? Does he mention that?
Nope.
But it's like, yeah, because it's one of those games where if you hypothetically, if you have a girlfriend who's not massively into football and you want to take her to like a nice afternoon out in an area where there might be nice pubs and stuff, to a lovely stadium where she might enjoy herself, that's a good place to go. But at these prices, you know, man, it's...
Oh, you're sounding very Keys and Grey to me, Lars.
Well, I took an ex-girlfriend to Fulham once. It was her first ever football match, and I suspect her last. But Fulham 0, Sunderland 0. And I remember the game because Kieran Richardson hit both posts and the upright with one free kick, and the ball still didn't go in.
On Saturday, Leicester are going to wear special shirts with Vichai Srivaddhanaprabha's name embroidered on them for the first home game since his death. They face Burnley. On Sunday, we've mentioned Liverpool, Fulham and the Manchester Derby. Arsenal, Wolves, that's an exciting one, isn't it, Paul?
Yes, although Wolves have lost three games on the bounce now. And it's the classic sort of journalist curse, because I wrote something about them, you know, having effortlessly earned promotion and then sort of adjusted to life in the Premier League, and maybe the wheels are coming off. I suspect not. I think they've got a lot of quality in that team, but they may have to. Naturally, defence is their strength, so I think they'll be all right in the long run.
I don't think they've been particularly terrible in any of those games. Watford kind of stifled their midfield a bit, but they were the better team against Brighton, and they were really unlucky not to get anything from the Spurs game. But up against Arsenal, who, as we've spoken about extensively on the pod, seems to specialise in getting wins without playing that brilliantly, do you suspect this will be another one of those games?
People have been saying that Liverpool are the only team that could turn it into a title race. Does anyone still think that?
I mean, if Morata is serious about scoring goals suddenly, then maybe Chelsea are. City will probably win it by 15 points, but Chelsea, if Morata is going to start scoring regularly, there's not a whole lot wrong with that team.
Yeah, I mean, Chelsea have a richer squad than I think I gave them credit for at the beginning of the season.
So it's more the race for second place. Your question,
my question was
about Liverpool falling away, right?
Yeah, not anyone else stepping up.
But they're only 2 points behind after 11 games. It's not, the breakaway hasn't happened yet.
I think it'll happen this weekend.
Did anyone like Ryan Giggs on Gareth Bale's recent form for Real Madrid? I haven't seen many of his games. They're not on Sky then, or in 11 Sports, and I don't have 11 Sports.
That's interesting.
Was he joking, or was this serious? It could have been just an exasperated comment about how hard it is to watch all the games now with all these broadcasters.
Oh,
but if he was serious, then that's a bit unsettling.
Is he not his national team coach?
He is, yes.
Is it not a professional responsibility of his to watch Gareth Bale's game?
Arguably.
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, Ellis James made the point a couple of days ago that Ryan Giggs has not been to see Swansea play since taking the Wales job, which also seems even more remarkable.
Especially given Gareth Southgate is roughly 3 Premier League matches every Saturday.
Mango Man says, what are your thoughts on Bradley Stoke FC getting a player called Bradley Stokes? I'm very impressed.
Can I just say, there was a time where Wolfsburg were managed by Wolfgang Wolf, and that was an amazing thing. They should get him back just for that reason. I don't know. I'm not sure if he's any good or not.
Let's finish the pod with Bollard Man. If you remember Monday's Bollard.
Who could forget?
Yeah. OMG, he writes. I can't believe Max read my nerdy email about bollards. I'm so embarrassed. My brain confused the Weeble toys with Weebles, the bollards. Same principles, though. So it doesn't take him much to get into talking about bollards again. I didn't think I'd be so happy hearing Barry say hi to my missus. I'm going to have to save this episode forever. Thanks, Pod.
You're welcome.
And thanks for today. Thanks, Paul McInnes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lars.
Thanks,
Citizen.
Max.
Thanks, Barry Glendenning.
Cheers, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.